Folks, we are going to get ourselves started. We don't have quorum yet, but I do want to take care of a few housekeeping items first. I know many of you are from Greater Minnesota and have testifiers from Greater Minnesota. We're going to try to accommodate that as much as possible, but I also want to give you an idea of what the order will be so that if you wanted to step out, get a cup of coffee, if you're not going to be here for a while, it will give you that chance to do that. However, if you step out and get a cup of coffee and you're not here when we call you, you miss your spot. So just be aware of that as well. We're going to start with Representative Miller and Representative Bliss on House File 1109. That's number one. Number two is going to be Representative Metza. Number three is going to be Representative Knobloch for his two bills. Number four is Representative Torkelson with his bill. Number five is Representative Daniels on his two bills. Number six is Representative Albright, because I understand he has some folks from Rochester and Duluth. Number seven is Representative Juergens. And number eight is Representative Clark. Number nine is Representative Detmer. And I'll be last. So that's the order, if that gives you an idea, just so you know. And let's see, we have... We're almost there. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have donuts this morning. We're actually celebrating my vesting in Social Security today, so I wanted to bring treats.
Congratulations. Awesome. Well, thank you, Representative Vogel. So you were born on St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, Madam Chair, to Elko Newmark, a German, and a Montgomery Czech. So,
wow.
I'm truly, yes. I'm truly inclusive.
You gave your mom luck then. That's nice to see. I love that. Well, we appreciate the treats, and we hope you have a safe and happy birthday today. With that, do we have quorum yet? Not yet. Okay, we're almost there. Representative Miller, I'm going to probably interrupt you as soon as we get quorum so we can take care of other housekeeping items.
Sounds good.
But with that, why don't you kick us off with House File 1109.
Madam Chair, thank you so much for allowing us to come here this morning. Members, thank you for coming here on a Friday. I know you're taking extra time away to do that. This is about a veteran home proposal in Montevideo and Bemidji, and I'm going to let my testifiers do the hall. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you. Chair Anderson and members of the House Finance Committee. My name is Angie Steinbach, and I am the Assistant City Manager for the City of Montevideo, and I'm also the spouse of an Army National Guard veteran. I would first like to comment that everyone from Montevideo area that is usually here with us today were unfortunately unable to attend because of the tragic passing of a local young veteran. So as they are here, they are in the funeral, at the funeral today. So I just wanted to let you guys know that. Excuse me. As you are aware, there are currently five veterans' homes spread throughout the state. The proposed Montevideo and Bemidji homes will be placed strategically in two underserved areas of the state. Veterans' homes provide opportunity for veterans to receive specialized care and a camaraderie with residents in the home. For many veterans, military service and operational deployment lead to a strong sense of identity and belonging. For clinicians working with veterans, demonstrating an understanding of the military experience can greatly enhance the therapeutic alliance and the delivery of effective treatment in comparison with traditional nursing homes. The 70-bed Veterans Home initial cost construction includes $30,716,000 for an estimated project cost. Of that, the federal share, or $20,475,000, and the state share, or one-third, of $10,240,000. Montevideo has raised funds toward the state share of $5,208,000, and Bemidji has raised funds towards the state share of $2 million. Initial funding considerations include House File 1109 and Senate File 1089. Both seek an appropriation of $16 million of bond funds to design, construct, furnish, and equip a new veterans home in Bemidji and Montevideo. Long-term fiscal considerations include information from the 2015-16 legislative fiscal note, long-term considerations for the Montevideo and Bemidji veterans homes. assumed cost to operate 70 beds in 2020, if the projects are built and operating in 2020, salary costs of $7,750,000, and non-salary costs of $2,450,000, for a total of $10,200,000, which includes an approximate 1.8 increase in salary costs per MMB guidance and a national average approximately 4.5% increase in non-salary costs annually. The total FTEs for this home would be 103. A general fund appropriation of $5,230,000 would be needed for operation of this home. Revenues from residents would make up the remaining revenue to cover the cost of operations. So we go into why Montevideo and Bemidji. Both communities have federally required project redesigns complete. Montevideo spent an initial $70,000 on our project pre-design in 2008 and complete updates biannually in order to make sure our costs are accurate. Both communities have land ready for the project. They have community-based outpatient clinics, and the communities have raised money towards the state share of the initial construction costs. Montevideo and Bemidji were both identified as ideal qualifying communities for Minnesota Veterans Home in 2009 Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs Community Identification Study for a new veterans home. They are larger rural communities and have hotels, bus and taxi services, American Legions, VFWs, retail shops, and much more directly within the communities. Montevideo and Bemidji both have advanced life support services and 24-hour acute care hospitals within their communities. They also have reports showing from DEED that there's ample prospective employees seeking employment in the regions. Splitting the allowed number of beds between the two areas of the state serves more of our state's veterans. This keeps veterans and their families closer together. The MNDVA has identified that operating veterans homes in between the 70 and 90 bed models is ideal for operations. Our applications and locations both meet federal and state guidelines. Proceeding forward, Montevideo and Bemidji need Minnesota legislative approval for the proposed veterans home projects. After approval, Montevideo and Bemidji have completed all requirements and are ready to work with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs on an application for federal funding. The proposed bills would allow Montevideo and Bemidji to separately complete federal applications for funds, not exceeding the state's authorized amount of bed. We would utilize 140 of the 144 beds. I would like to pass to Tim Foley.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Chair Anderson and members of the House Committee, my name is Tim Kolai. I served for 21 years in the Army Reserve in the Minnesota National Guard, retiring in 2007. I had a deployment to Iraq in 2004 and 5. I'm a former commander of my hometown American Legion post in Cottonwood, Minnesota, and a former commander of the VFW post in Montevideo. So I interact with veterans as a hobby and as a profession. For the last 6 years, I've been the County Veteran Service Officer of Chippewa County, Minnesota. So that one of the main reasons why we want the veterans home to be in Montevideo and Bemidji is that the number of vets in the area and to have the home as close as possible to their families and to reduce the drive time for them to visit. So one of the criteria for the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs is to have the veteran population within a 60-minute drive time. And for Chippewa County, that is 12,138 veterans from the counties of Big Stone, Chippewa, Candioi County, Yakapile, Lincoln, Lyon, Redwood, Renville, Stevens, Swift, and Yellow Medicine. We also have active National Guard units in the area, Montevideo, Madison, Appleton, Marshall, Ortonville, and Morris are part of the 1st Battalion of the 151st Field Artillery. Redwood Falls and Hutchinson are another National Guard battalion. They have 180 soldiers. Wilmer has a reserve and a guard unit, 220 soldiers. Olivia, 160 soldiers. And Wilmer has an Army Reserve unit also. Another important consideration is the age of the veterans that we have in the state. the largest group of veterans in the state of Minnesota right now are ages 65 to 75. And so they're at the age where they're just starting to think about long-term care. If some of them are not already in long-term care, I know the Laverne's Vets Home has quite a few Vietnam vets in it. The second largest group is from age 54 to the age of 55 to 64. And that next largest group is going to be next in line. So we consider the time it takes to build the veterans home, there'll be quite a few more people that are ready for it beyond what we have right now. There's a strong need for skilled care in the state of Minnesota for our veterans. Currently, we don't have enough veterans or enough skilled nursing care beds for even part of 1% of the veterans that we have in the state of Minnesota. The waiting list for the 860 beds that we currently have is, the waiting list is 1,500 people for those 860 beds, so almost double. Veterans have some specialized needs that traditional hospitals aren't very good with working on. Traditional hospitals are just starting to face things like PTSD, but veterans also face issues like Agent Orange, and those are unusual to traditional hospitals. Both Montevideo and Bemidji have VA community-based outpatient clinics that are used to dealing with this kind of care and have access to specialists on a short basis from that. On February 9th, 2015, we met with Commissioner Shelito and his staff from the State Department of Veteran Affairs. At that time, we were informed that there was currently 144 beds available for construction. The federal criteria changed from 12 beds to 10 beds per household unit. Based on these numbers, our architectural firm made a new pre-design with a 70-bed design, and the homes are going to be populated on a first-come, first-served basis. The state has looked at different ways of populating the vets' homes, but that seems to be most fair for all of them. So we'd be welcoming vets from all over the state, but with hopefully having them as close to home as possible. And that's the reason that we want them as far outstate as they are. I understand that the financial commitment of the state of Minnesota will be obligated for, and we're not the only ones that are asking for funding, but this is the 10th year that we've come down here and asked for the construction of this home. During the same 10 years, our local American Legion Honor Guard has provided military honors for more than 200 veterans' funerals. This is just in the immediate Montevideo area and doesn't even include all of my Chippewa County. These veterans took an oath when the nation needed them, and they deserve our support. I encourage each of you to visit the Minnesota Department of Veterans website and watch the video that they have on the veterans' homes in Minnesota. Our veterans need their home, and it's our responsibility to provide them with where they honorably served us. Their physical and mental injuries require specialized care, and they require world-class staff to meet those needs. Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs veterans' homes show that they do provide that world-class care. Many veterans also prefer the comradeship of other veterans, and they would get that at these homes. And no one understands the sacrifices of a veteran like another veteran. As you can see on the front of our proposal, we've met all the requirements for construction except for the state approval for bonding and the ongoing operational costs. We've demonstrated a need. This is the right plan. Make this the right time to give our veterans the care that they need. Thank you. And now I present pass the presentation to the family CBSO, Scotty Allison.
Madam Chair, because this is kind of a unique situation, I'm going to have Representative Bliss go ahead and join his people down here at the table. His time will be brief.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Scotty Allison. I am a Navy veteran. I'm an Army veteran. I'm a retired Army officer. And I am also the Beltrami County Veteran Services Officer. So I'll get started. In front of you, see a slide that shows some facts about our veterans in northern Minnesota. I'm not going to go over all of them, but we have 27,658 veterans in a 16-county area. You can see that it's an aging population. And, oh, by the way, we have one-third of all American Indian veterans are located in and around Beltrami County. Next slide. I just want to talk a little bit about service-connected disability. So what this does, it's important because this shows the different levels of disability. Now, these numbers are coming from the 16-county area up in the northern Minnesota. The greater the service connection, the greater the future medical needs. And of note is 1,533 of these veterans have a rating greater than 70%. So these people are quite disabled. Next. So this is just some basic information on veterans' homes. This shows the distribution of operating costs. You can see that, 50 the state and then 25 private and federal. Each veteran in the a veteran who's 70% or greater receives a per diem rate from the federal government for $389.95. If any veteran who's in there, regardless of disability, receives the veterans homes receive a per diem of $106.10. The maximum veteran can be charged if he can self-pay is $7,005 a month. And then when a veteran doesn't have any money, and then they take all of their income and also their spouse's income. Next. This is just some nursing home costs currently in Minnesota. These are median rates. You can see that this was taken from, again, work 2016 survey. And then the sources of payment include out-of-pocket, federal, Medicare, and then VA if it's a contracted VA facility like the Nielsen Place in Bemidji. And then also the state provides medical assistance. Next slide. So this slide basically shows you that all veterans receive a per diem in there. At the basic rate, I figured out to be about $2.7 million. If you take the 70% service-connected veterans, that's going to be increased. And then all veteran home residents have a maximum cost that they will ever pay. And then I've heard that nursing home costs on the outside basically rise according to the level of care need. So I gave you the median, but it could be it's a big bandwidth. So I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Vinny now, and I'm done. Thank you.
Mr. Vinny, please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Joe Vinny. I'm Beltane County Commissioner, 2004 through 2016. I am a life member of the Disabled American Veterans, Vice Commander of Disabled American Veterans Chapter 7, and an American Legion member as well. I think what we want to iterate and emphasize today can best be underscored by a letter from a veteran's family member in northern Minnesota. And I'll be quick about this, if you can imagine such a thing. My brother-in-law lived in Georgia previously, and is 100% service-connected disabled. He was a vulnerable adult and was put into a nursing home in Georgia. We tried for 6 to 8 months to get him transferred to Minnesota where he could be with his family. In November 2012, we moved him to a nursing home in Duluth where he could be closer to the family. Unfortunately, during this time, his brother, the only family member living in the area who could spend time with him on a regular basis, passed away. We live approximately 2 hours away, but we continued to visit him at least monthly. After his brother passed away, we felt it would be best to move him to Bemidji as we were the only family members he has left. This way he could be close to us and would not be alone. At first we were told this was not possible because St. Cloud had no money for contracts. In the meantime, hospice was put in place and we were then told that he would be able to come to Bemidji but would have to go to Fargo for treatment. The entire process was very intense and time-consuming. It appeared at times that the veterans' needs were put on the back burner and money was the driving force. There's a great demand for a veterans' home in our area, and that can provide quality of care to all veterans. A home also provided training, advocates to help veterans and family members better understand the process of the VA system. The biggest single deterrent we have in northern Minnesota is the distancing 2, 3, and 4 hours away from pre-existing facilities. That is unconscionable. Service is delayed, our service denied. And if I might quote President Trump, he said, veterans have taken care of us. Now it comes to us to take care of veterans. Thank you for this opportunity today.
Thank you. Okay, is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Members, do you have questions? Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if one of the testifiers or members could tell me, of the people that would be now in these veterans' homes, do you have any sense for where they are now? Are they in a nursing home or some other state facility? And the reason I ask is when I look at the fiscal note, I see the operating cost of each of these is supposed to be $5.2 million a year. But I'm not sure that that would really be the cost to the state. We just heard one individual talk about a veteran who was in a nursing home in Duluth. Presumably that person probably was already on medical assistance, and the state was probably already paying for the cost of medical assistance for them in that nursing home. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, what would the net cost to the state really be? I'm wondering if it's probably less than the $5 million that's in the fiscal note, dependent on where these veterans that would be in the homes would now be.
Ms. Steinbach, do you have an answer? Or I see Mr. Johnson, too. Do you have a comment to that? Can you help us out? And maybe Ms. Steinbach, you can tell us where the numbers came from.
Yeah, the numbers are coming.
To the microphone, please.
The numbers are coming from the Senate data of the veterans in their state, and they're also coming from our CVSOs who have more recent data on that. There would be a mix. Scott, you can also do this. There would be some initially when construction starts, there would be people who are on the list that would be able to move into the veterans' home. So, yes, there maybe are some funds that are already being expensed out by the state with that. As we move forward in time and we serve veterans throughout time, the Department of Veterans Affairs costs and the appropriation amounts are likely accurate with what they're predicting with it.
Okay. And Representative Knobloch?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'd just suggest that maybe as this bill moves through the process, you get some more information on that, because I think, you know, if you look at the total state cost or the net state cost, you might find that it's only half this if half the veterans are already in a nursing home or state facility somewhere else, and that might be an important consideration as we consider the bill.
Madam Chair, I would just
Representative Miller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Knobloch, I agree with you 100%, and that's one of the points that needs to be attested to. Because of brevity of time, we could not show that there is a cost that's already being incurred. To look at it a different way, some people say, why not put them into a nursing home? You heard the advantages as to why they're in their own home, but that is with the understanding and the presumption that there are already costs incurred if they're in a non-veterans nursing home. So perhaps the department has really, I think we're asking for specific numbers that you might have. Or
Mr. Johnson, can you tell us what it would be, though, you know, once you get beyond the initial first residents that maybe were covered in other areas, what would be the ongoing cost past that first initial time?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ben Johnson, Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And the fiscal note that we developed is updated and accurate. Our estimate is an approximately $5.2 million ongoing cost for operating. That includes it is what is necessary from the general fund. Revenues from residents would make up the remainder. Revenues would include the per diem that were described by the testifiers.
Representative Knobloch, any?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, again, I would just say, I mean, even going on into the future, I mean, once the homes are built, yes, the cost might be $5.2 million a year that you've got to send in a check to run the home, but I think people need to understand that those veterans that would otherwise be in the home, at least some of them, would be incurring state costs somewhere else. And so it's not really a net cost to the state of $5.2 million a year. And I think, you know, it would be good if the department could develop and get some sort of an estimate of what that net cost really is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I don't know if this is for Representative Miller or maybe Ms. Steinbach. I'm interested to see, Ms. Steinbach, if you have reached out to the area nursing homes and talked to them about what would the financial impact be to them and if that causes problems at all, and then also do we have the labor to be able to operating both nursing homes, nursing home for non-veterans versus the nursing home for veterans? Can you speak to that, please?
Correct. I'll go ahead and start. Each year we work with DEA to run employment analysis on our area, and we identify that there's a strong pool of workforce that's willing and able to work within both of our regions. In Montevideo alone, we've identified over 220 individuals seeking employment in healthcare and residing in one of the six counties listed above, and over 300 resumes were matched with the same keywords with willingness to work in Montevideo. So the staff is available, the workforce is available there. And I'm sorry, the first part again?
Well, talk to me a little bit more, though, about the skill level. So, you know, on the nursing side of it, you're going to have a higher skill level labor. So when you're looking at comparing it to the regular traditional nursing homes to the veterans, is there enough to be able to accommodate both? Are we going to be taking away skilled nursing staff from non-veteran nursing homes to be able to outfit the veterans home?
Chair Anderson, I went to the nursing homes in Beltrami County and have talked to them about this. Every nursing home wants the veterans home. The reason being is up in our area, we have long waiting lists for nursing homes. So, and in Bemidji, you know, we have a nursing program at Bemidji State, at a North Technical College. So we have an ample supply of nurses, and we hope, and with specialty skills. And then also we're looking at the doctor pool. We hope that it is an attraction for the veterans home for them to come up there. It certainly is for the Sanford Medical Center.
Tim.
And that is similar also with Montevideo as well. And these numbers that are provided by DEET are outside of the scope of individuals already working. These are people interested in coming into this area to work. There will, of course, be a shift initially that some people may receive employment, but then there's other people that are coming into the community, and there's job growth, and there's the opportunity for economic development with that, too, where people come to the communities, they want to work within the communities, and they can work up within the communities.
And the Nielsen Center, which is one of our nursing homes, which is also a VA contracting facility, even for the veterans that are 70% or disabled more that need that kind of level of care, there is long waiting lists, ma'am. So we have to put them somewhere else, even though that facility there would be, you know, their services would be paid for by the Veterans Administration.
Okay, I've got Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Mr. Johnson could fill a committee. And I know the VA, the federal VA, allows a per diem for these veterans as they're in the veterans' homes. And for a private nursing home, they have to get certified through the VA, and it's very difficult to get certified through the VA because of the special needs of our veterans. And if there's a veteran in a private nursing home, does that private nursing home get the benefit, the per diem, from these veterans?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair Anderson, Representative Detmer, I don't know the answer to that question. My understanding is that the contract beds are for 70% and above disabled veterans, and so they would be eligible for that higher per diem. But for those 70% and, or below 70%, I'm not certain. I can get the answer to that if you would.
And Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. But in order to get that, they would have to be certified by the VA. And I know there's a few private homes in the state that are certified, but it's a very difficult process to go through, and that's why a lot of the private homes don't go through that certification process.
So. We have one up in Bemidji that is that way, and they do receive a per diem. It's a smaller per diem than what is received at the veterans home.
Okay. Members, any other questions? If not, I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee officially to order. Members, in your packets, you have the minutes from March 16th. Representative Pugh, you want to move the minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move the minutes from March 16th.
Representative Pugh moves the minutes from March 16th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are adopted. I am going to move that House File 1109 be referred without recommendation to the Committee on Capital Investment. Any final comments, Representative Miller?
Madam Chair, thank you for this time. This is, of course, two communities coming together with a lot of, as you can tell, passion about this. So thank you for the time that you gave all of us. I do want to wrap up. I'm not sure, but each community has a very detailed book of information. Did you get a copy of that,
yes,
Madam Chair?
Yes, we did.
Wonderful. So thank you for your time, and I ask for your consideration.
Great. With that, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill is on its way.
Thank you.
Members, we've got Representative Netza, and I just want to highlight. So brevity is really appreciated. We have 10 bills on the docket today. So all of us have the information before us. If you can provide us with the highlights, that would be greatly appreciated. Right now, we're on track of going 5 hours. So if you can limit your comments, because we have people that are from a long distance and we want to try and get them home. So if you could do that, we would greatly appreciate that. Okay? So brevity is greatly appreciated. Representative Metza, I'm going to move House File 407 to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a, and thank you, committee members, and we will be brief. This is a $2.85 million request for a correctional facility. It's been through the committee a few times over the last years in the bonding bill, so I will turn it over to our testifier, K.R.O., who runs that facility.
Welcome to the committee. Can you please state your name for the record and who you represent?
My name is Kay Arla. I'm the Executive Director of Arrowhead Regional Corrections, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing me to present our request for $2.85 million to continue the investment and improvements at the Northeast Regional Correction Center. This request is being made on behalf of Arrowhead Regional Corrections. A little background about us, we're a joint powers agency that was formed in 1976, so we've been around over 40 years. It was formed by the five counties that make up the northeast region of this state, Lake County, Cook County, Couchiching County, Carleton County, and St. Louis County. So we serve a huge geographic region. We provide the correctional services in that region for those five counties, including all the probation services. We own and operate a 48-bed juvenile detention facility. And last but not least, we own and operate the Northeast Regional Correction Center, or as we refer to her as NERC. NERC is a 144-bed adult male facility. It is located about 15 miles north of Duluth in Saginaw, Minnesota. And it has been there in operation since the 1930s. It provides all traditional correctional programming that you would expect in a facility. So we have medical services, mental health services, educational, chemical dependency. But in addition, what makes NERC very unique is that it is also a working farm. That combination of correctional programming and farming is unique in the state. There are not other NERCs around, and we even have trouble finding a model that's similar in the country. So what we do at NERC is we grow crops and we raise livestock. So we grow hay and barley. We keep what we need, and it is a revenue source for us, so we sell what we don't use. We grow all kinds of vegetables, tomatoes, potatoes, onions, corn, you name it. We raise chickens, turkeys, and pigs. And everything that we raise, we process on site. So we have a meat processing facility where we process our livestock. We process all of the vegetables, and all of that is used to offset the expense of feeding the men. So I know one of the really trendy and expensive things right now is the whole term of farm-to-table. NERC has been doing farm-to-table since the 1930s, so they are way ahead of the curve here. We also have a unique approach to facilitating change in these men's lives. So a man's experience at NERC is when he comes to NERC, he is assigned to a work crew. So we have men that are working in the kitchen. We have men who do our inside janitorial maintenance, our outside maintenance. And a large number of them work in the meat processing building, learning some butcher and meat cutting skills, and also in farm operations. So that is what makes NERC unique. does that model work? Well, in corrections, one of the outcomes that we measure is recidivism. So you always hope your intervention is going to change the course of someone's life and that they will leave there and not continue to commit crimes. So the first thing I want you to understand about NERC is that we are not dealing with low-risk offenders. 80% of the men who serve their time at NERC are convicted felons. That should be of huge interest to the state of Minnesota, because the better that we can do with that group of men, the less likely they are to end up in a prison bed, where you are well aware you have some crowding issues. So we are working with the same population as the state prison. These are felons primarily. And when they serve their time at NERC, about 83% of the men who exit NERC do not commit a felony for 3 years from discharge. That's a standard definition of recidivism in Minnesota as well as nationally, and that is an excellent recidivism rate. So our project is actually a request to continue investment in NERC that has already started. And so you will see in the PowerPoint presentation that you have a copy of that the counties are very committed to NERC. They have invested over $7 million in capital improvement and asset preservation to date. Most of that investment focused on our main building. The NERC campus is made up of 42 buildings. So in the main building, that is where we house the men. It's where the kitchen and cafeteria food services are housed. Our administrative offices are there, and most of our program space. That building was in dire need of repair and fell far below life safety standards. So the counties have invested $7 million. The state has also invested in NERC over the past several years, and I want to thank you for your support. In 2012, the state granted us $737,000, which was used to replace the boiler system for the main building. In 2014, the state granted us $1 million, which we used to improve some of those other 41 buildings and provide a fiber loop so that we could enhance security and cameras on the campus. And in 2015, the state granted us $1.2 million to demolish and rebuild the meat processing facility. I need to report to you that for a variety of reasons, the scope of that project has changed and that we are unable to accomplish that goal for $1.2 million. When that project went out to bids, it is coming in as a $2 million project, and part of this request will be to make that the highest priority to get that project done. So this is phase three, and we purposely have had to stage the improvements at NERC because we continued to be fully operational during all of these renovations. We continued to house men and provide the correctional programming that was necessary, and so we've had to do this very purposely, incrementally. The $2.85 million will be focused on those buildings that support vocational skills. So the meat processing facility, where men are learning meat cutting and butchering, and some actually have walked out and found jobs in that area. Meat cutters are very hard to find, I'm told, and there are no training programs for them. We also would look for improvements in our welding building, our carpentry shop, and our mechanics garage. One of the things I want to highlight about the meat processing facility is that this is a high priority for several reasons. One is it has been cited by the Department of Corrections in their annual inspection as a substandard building. They have been very patient with us in continuing to allow us to use that building because they know we have a plan to replace it. I don't want to test their patience, and so I do want to move that project along. The second thing I want to highlight is that meat processing facility is meeting a very important need in our region. We process our own chickens, turkeys, and pigs, but we also allow farmers to bring their livestock, and for a fee, we process for the local farmers. I'm told by the farmers that they have no other access to processing facilities in the region, and without us, they have to drive hundreds of miles with their livestock to accomplish this. So we are very sensitive in the design, in making sure that we recognize the role we play to that greater community need and want to do it right. The carpentry, maintenance, and welding shops primarily need upgrades in air intake and would allow us to partner with trade unions and others to come in and expose men to some of those vocational skills. One of our objectives in corrections always is to integrate them back into the community and become responsible citizens, including employed. Our barns all need roofs. We have a root cellar that is a little scary place. It has no ventilation, no secondary exit, and it is where we store a lot of our produce so that we can use it in our kitchen year-round. I'm asking for you to continue your support and generosity with NERC because this is a project that not only meets a large geographic area of the state, but as I stated earlier, I think the state of Minnesota has a vested interest in us continuing to do good work with these men and offsetting the expense of sending them to prison. It is a program and facility that has demonstrated success, so you won't be gambling on whether this is a good investment or not. And it is an investment that the state and the counties have been making over the last several years, and we need to continue that momentum until we can hit completion. So I thank you for your time this morning, and I am asking for your support.
Great. Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Members' questions. Representative Ubram.
Madam Chair, I know that Representative Lilly and myself and Representative Vogel have toured this facility. I remember quite clearly it's a good project. I'll be very brief, but it's a very good project.
Any other questions, members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, how long are offenders generally staying in this facility?
Ms. Arola?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, men are allowed under statute to serve up to 12 months. At NERC, the average stay right now is under 90 days.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was assuming that this was similar to the Ramsey County Workhouse in my district, and I was always disappointed when they moved away from the farming aspect. I think working with the earth is a good way, and these materials and vocational skills are really important. They're also required to be less than 12 months, and I appreciate your local response to the needs in the community.
Ms. Arola, do you process deer as well, or...?
We have, in our long history since the 30s, we did do wild game, and we have not done that for probably more than a decade. So we do not do any wild game at this point.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 407 be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment without recommendation. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? I apologize, Representative. I assume you had no... further comments?
In brevity and out of respect to the chair, no, I don't.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. It's on its way. Okay.
Thank you.
Members, we are going to do Representative Knobloch. You can pick which bill you want to do first. You want to do House File 616?
I'll take 616 first.
Okay. Representative Knobloch, I'm going to move House File 616.
Thank you. And, Madam Chair, I'd also appreciate if you would move the A1 amendment so we can get the bill into the shape that it needs to be.
I move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Knobloch, treat bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I also have Representative Tice here with me, who is part of my Senate district and has many employees of the correctional facility in her district as well as the warden up in St. Cloud, Colin Dow, and Rick Nyson, who is on the staff at the correctional facility. Members, the St. Cloud Correctional Facility is the point of intake for all new inmates in our correctional system, all new male inmates. So what happens is when someone is sentenced, however dangerous or not so dangerous they might be, they first go to the St. Cloud
correctional facility for processing. It's been that way for a long time, but despite that, we have a very undersized entry point for these inmates. It is a dangerous situation that I can have the employees of the correctional facility talk about, and it has been recognized by such by the legislature to the point that we've had a two-phase project going on, the first phase of which was already funded a few years back to renovate our health facility and provide a new health facility so that we could then renovate the old health facility into more space for intake. Bill also provides for some other security upgrades, such as where we bring trucks into the facility to unload food and so forth for the facility, making that more secure than it is right now. So this is the second phase. It's $19 million, and I'd like to first recognize Rick Nyson, who is a employee at the correctional facility, and briefly speak a little bit more about the dangers and the need for this bill.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rick Nyson. I am here as a corrections sergeant for the Department of Corrections, a constituent of Representative Knobox, and a proud AFSCME member. Brevity is not my strong suit, so I follow direction well, so this will be quick. This is something, as Representative Knobloch alluded to, that is in the process. We're nearing completion on phase one. This was in the bonding bill last year. It's really not a need, or it's not a wish anymore. It's a need because we have a bridge started and we have to finish it. To speak on the security aspect of it, where that falls upon me as a corrections officer and as a union man who is very concerned about our safety of my fellow workers and union members, it is imperative that this go forward. We run approximately 700 people in and out monthly out of not much more than a broom closet. At any given time, we could have 30 to 50 offenders down there coming from all over the state without a whole lot of notice. So the logistical security aspect of it is really something that is important. That is really all I have.
We appreciate your brevity.
Thanks.
Anyone else?
I also have the warden of the prison, Colin Gao.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Colin Gao. Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives, for the opportunity to speak to you this morning to this project. As Representative Knobloch has indicated, this is actually the second phase of a single bonding project that we submitted. We were asked to phase it in order to spread out the funding costs. Phase one actually included design for phase two. So this phase two, the $19 million, is what we would call shovel-ready. And the continuity of construction would really be well served if we could do it now, because we are going to be wrapping up phase one by midsummer, and we could move immediately into phase two if the funding were granted. As has been said, the primary focus of phase two is security enhancements. We process a large number of offenders through a very small area. As of this morning, we had 11 offenders that were being transferred out to the Stillwater facility. Two of them got into a fight. We had to send our staff into that holding cell with 11 offenders to take the two fighting offenders out. That kind of situation is not safe for anyone, neither the offenders or for the staff. Our truck gate, our entrance point for vehicle traffic, has fully loaded vehicles driving all the way into our perimeter and then unloading. About 2 years ago, we had a vehicle come in to unload, and it was second stop from the St. Cloud facility was to the local Cabela's that had live ammunition in the vehicle. We really, really need that loading dock to be outside the secure perimeter for safety and security. So keeping with brevity, those are the issues that we are looking to resolve. This is primarily an issue of providing safe, secure places for our offenders as well as our staff.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Knobloch or Representative Tice, any other comments?
Not for me.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I would just like to say that we did a bonding tour a couple years ago, and I think Representative Lilly probably eyed up the wall. One of the things we did get to look at and wasn't mentioned was Tuck pointing the wall. Because you can climb up. You can climb up the wall because it's getting that bad. And while it might sound kind of for us a little bit, ooh, that sounds kind of fun, I'm thinking it probably isn't. Because there's guards up there with guns. And also seeing, as Mr. Nyssen said, seeing the coat closet that they have for intake and how those folks go coming and going are seeing each other and how they react to each other is quite amazing. So I'm not sure how they got anybody to work down there. I would not do it. But they definitely need, this is a need. It is a need. It is definitely a need. And they need to get the security where they want it to be. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Members' questions? Representative Knobloch, does the Department of Corrections have like a priority list like you see with PUC or Public Facilities Authority and some of those things at all? And is this ranked on a priority list at all?
You know, Madam Chair, I don't know if I know that offhand. I think it's very high on the priority list. Yeah, I am told that it is the number one priority after asset preservation. Yeah, number one priority after asset preservation for the Department of Corrections.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. With that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 616, as amended, be referred without recommendation to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The bill is on its way. Thank you, members. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right, we are now going to go to Representative Knobloch's House File 2290. I move his bill. Representative Knobloch, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 2290 is a kind of a housekeeping bill submitted at the request of Sherburne County.
I apologize. I don't have it in our possession,
No. So
we're just doing it as information while I moved it. I apologize.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I didn't hear you. I was talking to my testifiers.
Yes,
I'm
sorry.
Okay, yeah.
Go ahead.
It's an informational hearing.
Yes.
Yeah, House File 2290 is kind of a housekeeping bill submitted at the request of Sherburne County. It allows Sherburne County title examiners to continue to be paid as they have been in the past, even though the population of Sherburne County is now over 75,000. State law, which goes back over 100 years, provides that counties over 75,000 in population essentially have full-time title examiners, whereas smaller counties tend to have title examiners who are paid by the people who need their services. In Sherburne County and many smaller counties, people, for example, if you're subdividing land and you need the services of the title examiner to help you register the property, the person who is bringing the request pays for the costs for the title examiner so that the county itself doesn't have those costs. And Sherburne County would like to continue doing it that way as opposed to having to actually hire a county employee themselves. Other counties that have grown over 75,000 in population have these exceptions, and we'd appreciate Sherburne County being granted that exception as well. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone that wishes to testify to this bill? Members' questions? Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair and Representative Knobloch, it's got to be one of the biggest sentences I've ever seen from 114 to 122. That's got to be pretty epic there.
Well, as one of the staff members told me, Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, this is one of the more difficult to understand one-word bills that they've seen. But all it really says is Sherburne County would like to be able to keep doing things the way they've done them instead of having to actually hire a county employee now that they're over 75,000 in population.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Knobloch, it's, some of us are just luggage showers, so maybe that's more for the attorneys in the group. Thank you.
Well, Representative Lilly, I think all politicians are guilty of run-on sentences, so I'm guessing they just put it into statute. So, Representative Knobloch, how come we just haven't ever just fixed this as an overall for everybody? Have you looked into that at all? Or?
You know, Madam Chair, I guess the thought had occurred to me, too. I wasn't even sure what they were talking about when the county first approached me on this. And so I just kind of said, well, sure let's add Sherburne County to it. But yeah, in some ways I'd agree it's a little bit of an antiquated law, perhaps the way it's written, and I wouldn't be averse to trying to come up with a little bit better way of dealing with it.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate the information, Representative Knobloch. We don't have this in our possession, but appreciate you bringing this forward. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Comments? Okay. All right. We are done with Representative Knobloch. I've got Representative Torkelson next. House File 844. I'm going to move House File 844. Representative Torkelson, to your bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be before your committee. House will try to keep you closer to a reasonable schedule.
We appreciate that.
House File 844 is a appropriation to help move the Milford Town Hall from its current rural location to the edge of the city of Essig, small town of Essig. I have a testifier that can explain the details.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Michael Dove, D-O-V-E. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for this opportunity, and I will be brief. I've been a resident of Milford Township since 1994 and on the Milford Township Board of Supervisors since 1998. Milford Township is abutted next to the western border of the city of New Ulm. There's a it's a rural agricultural type of township, has some rural residences because of its proximity to New Ulm, but more importantly, has a unique structure called the Milford Township Hall. The reason we're here today. This was a former school that was in existence from 1912 to 1971 when the state mandated the closing of the rural schools. Since that time, it has continued to function as our town hall, except for probably about the last 10 years, because of the deficiencies. And because of those deficiencies, we're looking to move this into the unincorporated village of Essig, which is just a small little town. The township has a lot there, and that lot has running water and sewer capabilities to allow for the transition and formation and improvement of the town hall. But our largest, obviously, issue is handicap accessibility. At this point, we cannot use it as our annual town hall meeting room. We can't use it for elections. The handout that I presented to you, I have some detail in this, and this was put together by my spouse, who's actually teaching social studies today and was the real passionate driver behind this whole project. So I wanted to just give Deb credit for that part of it. But the bonding request is to allow us to move this building, to make it functionable, to make it accessible, and to allow the educational opportunities for younger students to come in and see what a rural schoolhouse would have looked like back in the 1912s. The pictures that are attached to the handout that has been circulated shows that the inside is virtually identical to what it was back in the 1920s. The old library, as you'll see on Exhibit C, is where we voted when we had voting there at the town hall, and everything is very conducive to showing and reflecting the true ability and what it was like to go to school there. So our goal is to move it into Essig, to update it so we can use it again as a town hall, as a place for voting, and also to provide educational opportunities for various individuals and entities or groups to use it as a social center. The one thing I do want to say also is that we're seeking to put in a basement. The city of Essig, or unincorporated village of Essig, doesn't have any safeties in case of bad weather. And there's a ball diamond about two blocks away from where we're looking to put it, so it would be also used as a safety shelter in the case of inclement weather that would come through during the summer. So thank you very much for your time, and I would ask you to support this bill.
Okay. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on this bill? Mr. Duff, well, how big is Essig? You said it's an incorporated, what's the population?
I suppose it probably has 75 people there, something like that.
Is there a church at all? Or
no church.
Any restaurant or anything?
There's one restaurant. Carl's Corner was voted best chicken in the state of Minnesota, I think, 2 years ago. It was the WCCO thing. It has a baseball field. It has a small elevator. There's also a new business coming in, but it's just kind of a stopping off spot. It's 7 miles from New Orleans, so when the trains would come through, it was a watering hole so we could at least get water for the engines.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking through the material, it appears as if the well is already capped, but I don't see anything in the cost, in the moving of the building, to include the cost of filling in or making safe the existing basement?
That's correct. We had a couple years ago, thank you very much for that question, Representative. A couple years ago we had an understanding with a landowner that we would be turning it over to him and he would be filling that process and you know, making it to be agronomically correct. Since that time, he has put his neighboring farm into REM, Reinvest in Minnesota program, and I presume that the township would take obviously all the proper steps that would be necessary to facilitate and cover that up in a proper manner. But that has been a change since this was prepared a year or so ago.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative
Detmer? Madam Chair, just a quick comment. After seeing this picture, I had a flashback. I attended a one-room schoolhouse back in the day in Rice County. So my brothers and sisters attended it too. One teacher, six grades,
yes.
Just across from my dairy farm. So yeah. A little flashback.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
Mr.
Dunn? Thank you, Madam. Just one thing. There used to be about four or five schools in Milford Township. While a couple still exist, they are now residences. So this is the only one in Milford Township and probably one of the few in the county of Brown that have the original integrity as the original schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm. Representative Edmer? Any other questions, members? Representative Torkelson, final comments?
Well, you might want to note on page six of the top picture, there's a, I think it's a light rail fan in the background. I'm not sure. One of the originals, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 844 be referred without recommendation to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The bill is on its way. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We've got Representative Daniels. Oh, Petersburg? Oh, okay. Representative Petersburg, I understand you're pinch-hitting for Representative Daniels on both of these.
That is correct, Madam Chair. He's still unavailable for a presentation, so I am very happy to fill in as one of the co-authors.
Very good. Well, this is House File 763. We'll start with that. That's on the Minnesota State Academies. And Representative Petersburg, to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee for hearing this. Members, this bill it really talks about the Minnesota State Academies and Faribault. They've been providing services for people with challenges, both in hearing and in sight, for over 150 years. And this bill simply is requesting some dollars for infrastructure repairs and needed preservation issues. The academy, where it is also a school district, is also a state agency, and because of that, there are a lot of differences with it. But to deal with the specifics of the need, I would, if you so choose, Madam Chair, turn it over to my testifiers for giving more detail.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Is it Mr. Wilding? Yes. Welcome. If you can please state your name, well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to come. My name is Terry Wilding. I am the new superintendent for the Minnesota State Academies. I supervise two schools. We have the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf, and they are on two separate campuses about 1 mile apart in the city of Faribault. I have two bills. Before I start, I do want to mention that we have three projects. I'm not really sure how it works in the two bills. I'll just explain through that, and then you have the papers. It explains a little bit more in depth. The biggest portion is for asset preservation, and that is critical because we have many old buildings on our campus. Like Representative Pieper just mentioned, they're quite old. They're 75, 80, 100 years old, so we need to maintain those buildings. Two of our buildings are on the National Register of Historic Places. One building that we're currently focusing on is Noyes Hall. It is one of our oldest buildings on campus and is in need of a new roof. We do have some structure and some repairs that need to be done. That'd be about $2 million. And because of it being a unique building, as you can see in your packet, it's the building with the rotunda. It has two separate wings. That's why it's such a high cost to fix that. And also, you know, maintaining that building is important. We have done some work in the building in the past, and we don't want the roof issues to ruin the work that we have done, so that's why we're asking for that money. The second portion is for our school buildings. We have two main school buildings, or two main academic buildings, that are connected with Noyes Hall. We did a safety and security audit a few years ago, and it was recognized that the area is very weak. We don't have a central check-in point where our visitors can come into the building, check in with a receptionist, and then head to the classrooms as a visitor, or deliveries, et cetera. Oftentimes, individuals can bypass our secretaries and as they go into those separate buildings. So it's critical that we need to improve that. We're asking for some money to take a look at a design and how to connect those two academic buildings better and to develop a central place that's more safe. We do have deaf and blind students, so safety is, you know, very unique. It's not the same as most of the public school districts. You know, we can't use an audible alarm. We need to have something that's visual. The access needs to be visual, so that way they can, individuals coming in can be supervised appropriately. We're also residential schools, so that means that parents are they have increased concerns about sending their kids away from home to our campus. So we want to make sure that the school is safe for everyone. The second project that is we need to identify a need and a plan, and then next year we'd like to come back and ask for specific money for making that improvement to those buildings. So right now we're looking at the money for design. Third project is looking at a track. Requesting $600,000 for a new track and field on our campus. Currently, I think we're one of the few public schools within the state that has no track. Our health and wellness programs, our PE programs, our athletics programs would have, you know, they have no place to practice, to run, walk, et cetera. Thus far, we, or up until now, we've been able to make use of the track at Shattuck St. Mary's, the private school, which is next door to us. We've been using their track. It's not 100% accessible, but we've been able to borrow use from that. But next year, Shattuck is planning to improve their campus, and they will be removing that track, and it will become a parking area for their athletics facilities. So currently we're stuck. We have no place for training, for classes. So we're asking, I'm not sure where that part of the bill is. I'm working with Representative Daniels. Unfortunately, he's been out sick this week, and he said that we would figure out that. But those are the three portions of the things that we are in need for improving our campuses. And we hope that we have your support for those three bills.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? If not, Representative Fenton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And I've had the pleasure to tour the Minnesota State Academies, and I absolutely agree that these projects are necessary. They're doing some great things there, but these projects are desperately needed, and I agree with these bills. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just wondering, just to backtrack for a second, do you know the status of the, I think we bonded for the main building. Is that complete, that project? Because there were some really dangerous sight lines and some buildings that were made in the 70s that, you know, just didn't function well. And then it seemed like you needed some work on your theater as well, and I don't know if you're going to proceed with that or if that's a future request. Thank you. Sorry.
Representative, can you please clarify the sight lines? A previous project? Could you please clarify your question?
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we toured, I believe you had a main building that students would come into, and some of the sight lines, when you came in the main door to the left, I think they were kind of problematic and not safe, like you mentioned earlier, for students and staff. And then I think you were redoing that kind of commons area or something.
Mr. Wilding?
Yes, Representative, you are correct. That project, that's what we want to improve. We still have that problem. As you access the different buildings, there is no central place where individuals can come in. and to meet a receptionist, get the ID badge. You know, people can walk in without stopping by one of the offices in each of those buildings. So it is important that we do fix that.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. I grew up in Faribault, and I know both the athletic teams from the wrestling team from the School for the Blind and also the football team for the School for the Deaf competed and scrimmaged us all the time. So it's just great to have that sharing of experiences with those two historic facilities. And they really have these needs, too. Thank you.
Mr. Wilding, because you have two buildings that are on the Register of Historic Places, are they eligible for funds either from the federal level or from the State Historical Society for renovation at all?
As far as I understand, not really. If we want to change the buildings, we could get some money, but it'd be maintenance, so we'd have to use asset preservation for those funds. That's my understanding. Again, you know, I'm new here. I've only been here about working 6 or 7 months, so I'm still learning. But my understanding is, no, we don't have access to any other funds.
Okay. I'll maybe visit with Representative Daniels on that. But Mr. Kelleher, can you help us out on that? Do you know? Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. We do not have a specific pot of money that help under grant programs that helps state agencies with state facilities. Typically, those requests go through the bonding committee and typically through asset preservation requests. The state, of course, has a large number of historic structures, and we encourage the Capital Investment Committee to take care of those buildings. I don't know that there's a lot of federal money available for an effort such as this. Federal brick-and-mortar dollars are fairly scarce. Generally, legacy dollars, since that question comes up periodically, there's a question about whether legacy dollars should be used for state facilities, for brick-and-mortar facilities, because the traditional source of funding, that's the language that's used in the constitutional amendment for legacy, traditional source of funding for taking care of the state's buildings is the bonding bill. So we've avoided using legacy grant dollars for that, but rather legacy grant dollars more typically go to nonprofit organizations that have no other way to fund their historic structures.
Okay. All right. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several sessions ago, Senator Sinjman and I extended the deadline on a state program that allowed for matching federal dollars on historical sites, but I think that deadline is pretty much passed.
Mr. Kelleher?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I think what you're referring to is the Historic Preservation Tax Credit. That program was extended through 2021. That is for income-producing properties, so those are private sector structures where investments are made by the private sector and matched. And as I'm describing this, we have sort of a setup that the tax credits are used for privately held buildings, bonding bill is used for publicly owned buildings, and the legacy amendment dollars are used for nonprofit buildings. And that system seems to work pretty well.
Okay. Members, any other questions? If not, Representative Petersburg, do you have any closing comments at all? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you heard from the superintendent, he kind of represented three different wants. Two of the bills are in front of you today. Another one is being worked on. This bill here really talks about the $2 million needed for the infrastructure, primarily for roofing. Obviously, you got to keep the roof tight in order to keep the rest of it good as well. So we just ask for your support and approval of this bill moving forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. And members, what we really heard in the presentation here was both House File 763 and House File 764. The House File 763 is for the noise and Tate Hall portion,
and the 764, I believe that's just for the asset preservation. You can track it in the handout that the Minnesota State Academy has provided to us in here. So if you look for that, that gives you all the details. So I'm going to move both bills, and so we can get Mr. Wilding on his way. So I'm going to move House File 763 and House File 764 be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment without recommendation. We'll start with House File 763. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? House File 763 is on its way to Capital Investment. I'm going to move House File 764 be referred without recommendation to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And that bill is on its way as well. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Thank you, Mr. Wilding. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we've got Representative Albright. I understand you have some testifiers from Duluth and Rochester. I'm going to move House File 2274.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. And your testifiers, oh, they're on their way. Great.
They are. Madam Chair, I also have an author's amendment.
I'm going to move the DE1 amendment. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam.
Your bill is now in the order you wish. Representative Albright, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make my statement brief for the purposes of the committee. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 2274 is a product of a lot of work by a lot of people and communities throughout the state of Minnesota. Many of our communities have been struggling with how to best serve people who are experiencing from mental health crisis. Too often, the only options are confrontation with law enforcement officials or a challenging visit to the hospital emergency room. Neither law enforcement nor emergency room staff are professionally trained to work with people who are experiencing a crisis in mental health. The outcomes are almost always bad for both the individual involved and society as a whole. The individual does not get the help they need, while the emergency room or jail stay drains valuable state and local resources. Officials from hospitals, county social service agencies, law enforcement agencies, and our courts have been working together to come up with solutions to this costly problem. House File 2274 is the result of that work. The bill before you as amended would provide bond proceeds or cash for up to 6 such centers across the state. Before any of these centers receive money for construction, they would have to demonstrate that they have the financial wherewithal to properly staff the facility, to treat individuals who come to them in crisis, as well as the overall operations. I have with me two representatives, Mr. Cook from Zumbro Falls, as well as Ms. Metzger from St. Louis Hospital, who can tell you a bit more about their experience and their approach. And with that, I turn over the rest of my time before your committee to them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
My name is David Cook, and I'm representing Southeast Minnesota in Region 10.
Go ahead, Mr. Cook, and then we'll get Ms. Metzger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am the Chief Executive Officer at Zumbro Valley Health Center, the Community Mental Health Center, or Health Center in Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity to meet with you about the importance of this bonding bill. I'm speaking today with the support of Olmsted County, Southeast Minnesota, NAMI, Mayo Clinic, Olmsted Medical Center, Zumbro Valley Health Center, and many other providers in the region who support the idea of addressing a lack of appropriate services for individuals in a mental health or chemical health crisis. For the past 2 years, community partners have been collaborating to address gaps in services and the increasing use of the emergency departments for crisis services for individuals, families, and law enforcement due to a lack of a viable alternative. A medical trauma unit is often an in-hospital place for a person in a mental health crisis and may at times escalate symptoms rather than provide the environment for a supportive and comprehensive de-escalation of the crisis. We are all in the support of creating a regional behavioral health triage center as an alternative to the emergency department to divert individuals in a crisis to a more appropriate setting. To assist in relieving this problem, we are proposing a level of care between mobile crisis and the emergency department that provides a warm, welcoming, and supportive environment. that will be staffed by mental health professionals, a psychiatrist, and peer specialists, all of whom are trained in working with individuals in crisis. Specifically, the 24/7 Regional Behavioral Health Triage Center will have the capacity for 6 adult crisis beds and 3 child adolescent beds, with the ability to stay for up to 24 hours. Many crises can be resolved within this time. There will also be 3 beds that would be designated for a 1 to 3 day stay for extended evaluation and care coordination to link them with appropriate services at discharge. This triage center may alleviate the need for higher-level placements and give the staff time to find the right placement for the individual. The triage center would also include a receiving area for law enforcement. This initiative is also supported by the Governor's Task Force on Mental Health in the report dated November 2016. Key recommendations included creating a robust set of programs and services, as well as a recommendation to improve a set of crisis services to increase access and effectiveness of mental health care. In a recent edition in the Post Bulletin in Rochester, it was noted that the Rochester Police Department responded to over 900 mental health-related crisis calls annually and devotes thousands of hours to crisis resolution. Currently, the police must often resort to transporting the person to the emergency department for professional care. Our experience and also in consultation with medical professionals in the emergency room, we know that many people transported to the ED could have been diverted to a 24/7 crisis triage center. We have created a tentative financial model that's based on utilization assumptions with occupancy at around 50%, and we believe the billings for services would come close to covering the expenses of the triage center, not to mention the savings to the system by diverting a number of crisis patients to a more appropriate, less expensive setting staffed by mental health professionals. As noted in the Governor's Task Force Executive Summary, there should be an expectation that mental health and substance abuse disorder care is as accessible as physical health care. We believe this model would provide a more appropriate and welcoming environment for those individuals in a mental health crisis and a more successful transition to additional services if needed. Thank you for your time to speak to this initiative, and I stand for questions from the committee.
Okay, Ms. Metzger, is there anything you wish to add?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Erin Metzger, and I am the manager for outpatient mental health services at St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth, Minnesota. And I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2274 and on behalf of a Greater Minnesota Collaborative that has come together to prevent people experiencing mental health crisis from falling through the cracks in their own communities. On average, more than 500,000 adults in Minnesota have a mental illness, but only 48% receive treatment. From 2007 through 2014, Minnesota hospitals experienced a 49% increase in all mental health emergency department visits for all ages. The Minnesota Department of Corrections estimates a third of all inmates are taking medications for a mental illness, and St. Louis County Jail statistics near this estimate. In 2015 alone, it cost $37.1 million to care for the top 200 utilizers of the emergency department and inpatient mental health units in our region's 2 hospital systems. This tells us that we're not providing the outcomes for our friends and families that they deserve, and we can do better by not criminalizing the mentally ill and making appropriate and quality care accessible to all when they need it the most. Our region has developed a collaborative of organizations that care for people experiencing mental health crisis across the continuum. We've partnered with local hospitals, community mental health providers, St. Louis and Carleton County Human Services, St. Louis County Attorney's Office, and the Public Defender's Office, state representatives, the Duluth Mayor and Duluth City Council, St. Louis County Commissioners, homeless outreach and advocacy groups, local health initiative groups, mental health specialty court, and the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Duluth chapter. This collaborative has come together to map our existing regional adult mental health crisis continuum of care to help us further identify gaps in services. And we are also in the process of developing a community model for a 24-hour first point of contact for people experiencing a mental health crisis. This hub would allow for immediate assessment and then appropriate triage into the existing mental health system. It would allow us to connect people with supportive services, provide short-term stay in order to develop and complete comprehensive community discharge plans. House File 2274 would allow us the tools and opportunity to work towards our regional and community vision, and I would be happy to stand for questions after this testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Metzger. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Afterhold. I'm Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I really do want to thank Representative Albright. We've worked together on many mental health issues, and Senator Senjum as well for their interest in this issue. Last fall, I did actually a 40-city tour of Minnesota, so really went to every part of the state to learn what was happening in a mental health system. And one of the big issues is what we would call a flow issue, that people aren't getting through the system in an appropriate way. Certainly there's an issue of emergency rooms, also the fact that, you know, we have police picking people up and bringing them to the jails, and that's been a long-standing issue. And trying to address that over the last decade, we have developed mobile crisis teams, we have developed crisis homes, and several hospitals have actually created psychiatric emergency rooms where the lights are lower, you have mental health practitioners and professionals there. One of the problems we've seen is that, frankly, sometimes we have emergency room physicians who say these aren't our patients, but frankly they should be, and sometimes people have a co-occurring disorder, co-occurring healthcare issue. We also noticed on my trip that we couldn't find one urgent care in the state of Minnesota that provided mental health services, and we thought this was a real problem because then you could go earlier in your crisis and not wait till it was, frankly, full-blown and you needed emergency room care. The other thing we've seen is that although they have had the ability to do it under state law, 911 operators do not refer people to a mobile crisis team. And so when people call 911, the police come out instead of a mobile crisis team. So we have a criminal justice response instead of a healthcare response. One of the things that we found is when we talk to emergency rooms, we are seeing that people are getting assessed. The problem is once they're in emergency room, especially if they don't need hospital level care, they have nowhere to go. And what we've seen in the mental health community through the Mental Health Legislative Network, which is 40-some organizations, is that we need those places to go. We need crisis homes. We need intensive residential services so that people can get out of the emergency rooms instead of being stuck there because there is nowhere for them to go and it's not safe. This type of issue was raised several years ago. It's a little bit different than what we've heard today, but they built these crisis centers, particularly in states that frankly had very poor mental health services that were ranked, you know, 49 or 50 or 48th in the country in terms of spending on community mental health. And what we found in talking to them is that what we created was a new shining revolving door because people came in and they got assessed, but they still had nowhere to go. And they were released maybe after 24 or 48 hours, but they came back. And their recidivism rate was actually very high because we hadn't really resolved the problem. One thing I would like to suggest is that, again, when I've traveled around the state, people are getting assessed but nowhere to go, is that we look at maybe, and I'd love to work with the author to create some more flexibility, because what we've heard from other areas of the state is what they really want are crisis homes where people can stay up to 10 days and, you know, have their mental health become stabilized, certainly much cheaper than hospital level care, but also for intensive residential treatment services. Several years ago, the Bemidji area said this is what they wanted to do, and so we got the language changed to say, well, pull back and really look at it, and what they really want to do now is build an IRFs facility where people can go for a longer period of time. One of the things I would just mention is that in the Governor's Task Force report, actually the recommendations on crisis were to do more warm lines so that we get earlier ahead of the crisis, for crisis teams to co-locate in critical access hospitals in rural Minnesota so that you actually have the staff who can handle this and move with people into the community, to have urgent cares actually take care of mental health crisis. I mean, that's what hospitals did when they had too many people coming to the emergency rooms, is they created urgent cares in more crisis homes. So again, we're not opposing the bill, but we would like to work with the author to make sure that the needs of the communities around the state are really addressed.
Okay. Is anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Representative Albright, did you have any comments, or are you okay with us going to questions next?
I'm fine with going to questions next. Thank you.
Members, any questions? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I would like Ms. Adler-Holden to come back. I have a couple of questions. You mentioned warm lines, and I don't understand what that is. And the other is the 911 response, that they have the opportunity to call a crisis intervention team, I believe you said, or something similar to that, but they don't do it. And understanding the public safety issues that might be involved in that, how do we resolve that?
Ms. Adler-Holden?
Madam Chair, Representative Moore. So warm lines are actually staffed by peer specialists, so people who live with a mental illness. It can be a way to just talk through things. You know, someone's the symptoms are coming back, they're getting agitated or anxious, and they can call the warm line and really kind of work through some of those issues in a very simple way. So it's very early on in a developing crisis. With respect to the 911 operators, so we did change the law to say that they could do that, and we've only had a couple places in the state. Actually, the city of St. Paul, after a tragic incident, decided to change how they did that, and they brought everyone together to say, how can we work this better, so that the 911 operators now can do a warm handoff with the crisis team to say, this person is really having a mental health crisis, it's not necessarily for law enforcement to come out, and we'll send out the crisis team. Sometimes, if they're not sure about the severity of the crisis going on, they'll send out both the police officer and the crisis team, which also makes some sense. And that way, if it really is not a criminal issue, then the crisis team can take it from there.
Representative Warren. Members, any other? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Metzger, for being here from Duluth, and I appreciate that you talked about the coordination in our region. I think that's really something that's unique and wonderful about our community as we really come together, and I know mental health is a big thing that we're really talking about, so I appreciate this, and I appreciate the bill. My question is, I toured the Birch Tree Center not too long ago. How is this similar or different from what's being proposed in this?
Ms. Metzger.
Well, Birch Tree Center, we have a short-term crisis stabilization housing, which is their 16-bed facility, and they house the mobile crisis response team. This place would be a 24-hour first point of contact. Birch Tree Center and the mobile crisis team are called to respond in the community, so sometimes, depending on what's going on, there's a delay in that response. And so this would be able to get people to get help here and in the now and then feed into our further stabilization utilizing the Birch Tree Center and then allowing the place for the mobile crisis response team to respond 40 minutes or an hour later if there's a delay. So it's really trying to look at how we can leverage our utilize our existing services better and then what are the gaps in what we have right now. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Representative Albright.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this issue this morning with you.
I am going to renew my motion that House File 2274, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the bill goes to HHS. Finance, excuse me. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Members, we have Representative Juergens' two bills. We'll start with House File 1895. I move House File 1895.
First bill.
You rock. Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Well played.
We have a little tradition here in the House that freshmen have to bring treats every time their bill is heard. It's our own version of hazing, I guess. Representative Juergens, I move House File 1895, if to your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I want to make sure I've got the two bills in the right place here. And actually, I want to pass this book around before I get to the bill on page 110 is a picture of the courthouse that we're talking about.
Page 110, folks, in the book that he's passing around, Representative Fenton. So we're doing the one that's first in the City Hall and Police Station.
Correct. And I want to thank Mr. Kelleher from the Historical Society. He just happened to have that book with him today and thought it might be handy. Members, we've all marveled at the beautiful restoration of our Capitol building. In Hastings, we have a historic city hall, the former Dakota County Courthouse, that is over 30 years older than our Capitol building. We know that time, effort, and money is needed to preserve the historical significance of these beautiful and functional buildings. We're asking for $7 million for design, engineering, and renovation. This will include masonry repairs, replacement of the dome cupola, roofs and decorative metal, foundation work, and HVAC improvements. I have a testifier from the City of Hastings, the City Administrator, Melanie Mescoli.
Ms. Mescoli.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this morning. As Representative Juergens mentioned, Hastings City Hall and the Public Square campus is a treasured landmark. We have been the caretakers of this campus, which includes our police station, beautiful open spaces you'll see in the pictures, and mature trees. As you approach Hastings from the north, you can't help but be taken in by the visual of this building. The City Hall, former Dakota County Courthouse, has been in service since 1871, 146 years. It holds architectural and cultural significance in the state of Minnesota. In your packet, we have provided a brief handout illustrating just some of the needs of the building. We have provided also a structural, exterior envelope, and historical correctness evaluation for City Hall. This is one of the many analyses that we have completing or in the midst of completing to prepare a comprehensive plan for preservation and restoration of the site. Other reviews have included space and functionality needs and HVAC analyses. With 63 nationally designated historic properties and 170 locally historic properties, history is part of the Hastings community and identity. And in the late 1980s, our city council showed foresight, worked with the state, our county, and other partners to renovate the courthouse into City Hall. These buildings are part of our identity. We welcome public meetings, group retreats, historic tours, even have had plays in City Hall, because we see this as a Minnesota landmark, and we are tasked with caring for it. As Representative Juergens mentioned, with the recent work in the state capitol, we are looking at a historic treasure which requires careful preservation and restoration. As with the state capitol, the city is looking to repair crumbling stone, increase energy efficiency, update aged mechanical and electrical systems, and preserve the essential design elements. As you will see in the handout, we have a number of needs, including repair to the impressive domed roof. The underlayment is currently in poor condition. It's the element that maintains water tightness, so any breach can result in water seepage and damage. Additionally, complete replacement of the ornamental, galvanized, and painted metal, which decorates the dome roof, will ensure long-term durability. We have examples of brick and limestone masonry, which are showing signs of deterioration, flaking, and spalling. We can take measures to reduce the amount of water being absorbed into the stone and consequently slow the deterioration. It's also recommended that site regrading be conducted and HVAC improvements be completed to control the interior environment. This will help minimize swelling and shrinkage of the wood framing and minimize ongoing cracking of walls and ceilings. And as you are well aware, care must be taken to ensure any necessary interventions apply with standards for preservation and rehabilitation done in a careful and measured manner, and the work must be performed by qualified workers. The city's goals with this project are to honor and respect the history of this building and this campus and its story while taking necessary steps to preserve this state asset. Thank you for your time this morning. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Members, questions? I just have one question. So you mentioned in here that the city has been putting money aside. How much do you put aside on an annual basis for the maintenance of the facility?
Well, for the actual maintenance,
meaning the capital repair of the building.
We have about $550,000 cash on hand in our budget stability fund.
Okay.
And so how much do you put in per year towards that then?
That has varied from year to year.
Okay. All right. Members, any other questions? All right. With that, Representative Jurgens, any other comments?
Just that this is a beautiful building. I had the opportunity to attend a meeting there a couple of weeks ago, and I encourage all of the members this summer. There's a lot of fun activities in the city of Hastings. I welcome you to come down and take a look for yourself.
Okay. With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1895 be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment without recommendation. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the bill is on its way. Thank you, Ms. Mescal-Lee. I appreciate that.
Representative
Jurgens, we've got House File 1925.
Yes, and I've got a testifier to come down for that, too.
I'm going to move House File 1925. Chair Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Minnesota Veterans Home in Hastings is committed to providing a full continuum of high-quality care and service focusing on rehabilitation, reintegration into the community, and supportive care for veterans. The Hastings Veterans Home provides a variety of services for veterans suffering from chemical dependency, mental health illnesses, and the debilitating effects of aging. Prior to becoming a vet's home in 1978, this facility was a mental hospital. As with any building or campus, regular maintenance must be performed to keep it in good working order. I have one testifier to give us the details on those improvements. Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ben Johnson, Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to start out by thanking Representative Jurgens for visiting the campus and allowing us to introduce him to the home and some of the needs. Thought it was a very very nice visit and gave us an opportunity to show him what we do down there. With regards to this bit of legislation, we appreciate his introduction. It allows us to highlight some of the needs of the Veterans Home at Hastings. I would highlight that this language was included in the bonding bill, which went through the full vetting process last year and is also included in the omnibus capital investment bill that has been introduced this year by Representative Erdahl. This is a slice of those projects duplicated in a way that gives us an opportunity to highlight our needs. Minnesota developed the facilities condition assessment process, including reporting measurements, which resulted in consistent, accurate, and real-time information regarding the conditions of properties owned by the state of Minnesota. Data is collected and entered into the state's archivist system. It allows us to put all the state facilities and buildings owned by the state of Minnesota in the same set of criteria. And you'll notice in the handout that was provided, the FCA ratings for these are poor, which is essentially a potentially critical, requires action, or it will become a priority one, which is failing within a year. Again, this is only six of the full contingent of issues that we're facing at the Hastings Veterans Home, but these are the ones that are the most critical and have been set aside by the agency as priorities. In the interest of time, I'll happily cede my position here. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Do you, Ms.?
Okay. Well, Madam Chair and committee members, I would just like to see in support of the Hastings Veterans Home and their requests, and their they are a community asset, and they provide many, many needed services. So, we do appreciate them coming forward today.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Mescal-Lee. Members, any questions? I have a couple of questions, Mr. Johnson. When was the last time we did the roof? Because I'm looking on page 2, and I'm just a little confused by that. So what was the last time that we did work on the roof?
So, Madam Chair, to your question, portions of the roof were repaired in 2003 and again in 2008. This FCA rating is 3. They're based on the 4 and 5 scale of the western portion of that roof. So we were able to do portions of it. However, altogether, basically 75% of the remaining roof is a 1 or a 2 rating. So combined, they're at 3. But in reality, it's been about 9 years since we've done work, and they are continuing to deteriorate.
Okay. And Mr. Johnson, so how much did we spend in 2003 and 2008 for those replacement of those sections? Do you know?
Madam Chair, I don't know offhand. I'd be happy to get that to you. I can get it to you today.
It would. That would be great. And with it being a flat roof, if we replace it, are we going to really solve the problem, or are we going to be back again in short order? I know flat roofs are a pain in the keister. So can you help me with that?
Again, Madam Chair, my understanding is that it would be addressed in a way that would be a long-term fix. I don't know.
Longevity of it? I mean, is it a 20-year roof? How long does it?
I believe it would meet construction standards for longevity required by the Department of Administration, but I don't know what the actual lifespan of a new roof would be.
Okay. All right. Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm thinking of maybe some longer-term ideas in terms of water collection, preservation, reuse, as long as you're working on a flat roof and maybe thinking about a different design. Is there some interest or thought about using this as a vehicle, an opportunity to create a better way to not only keep the water out of the building, but to keep it in terms of long-term use of the space, keeping it, preserving it, but maybe redesigning it so it could actually serve this purpose better, as well as water retention, collection, reuse.
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Representative, the quote is based on contracting estimates from early last year, actually, 2015, and I don't know that quote considered renewable, though I know that the agency has embraced the governor's recommendation that the state agencies consider that going forward, and we're happy to take its action.
All right.
Madam Chair, just as a recommendation, I would suggest that be considered.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I'm just curious. I wonder if it would be able to support something like that. You know, typically you have to have the construction from the ground up to accommodate for things like that because they become quite heavy. But, you know, I'm not an architect. I only,
right.
Yeah. Am I, yes, Representative.
Thank you. In my prior life, I used to manufacture roof coatings in addition to all the paint and everything else. And, you know, I'd be willing to bet you this is a built-up roof, which is a tar and gravel type roof. And typically they're a 20-year roof. They're very heavy. Mm-hmm. There are other alternatives even for flat roofs. And some of the EPDM rubber membrane type roofs that provide warranties. But the standard warranty in the industry is roughly around 20 years. The whole key on a flat roof is to get adequate drainage. And that can be achieved rather than rebuilding the whole roof and everything else by simply putting in more roof drains and scuppers to alleviate. Any place you have ponded water on a roof, you're going to have problems. And it's just like a road. When you got that, you're going to have degradation. So, you know, a good architect who's running this project and everything else will take that into consideration, I'm sure.
Representative Warren?
Thank you. That's really what I was hoping for, that we can actually do the drainage on it, but then that water can be used for other things. I'm familiar with some places that are using it for flush toilets and things like that, so that we're not just putting it down the sewers and leaving a flat roof that needs to be redone more frequently as well.
Thank you. Okay. I love this. All of our members with different backgrounds. This is great. Thank you. Representative Juergens, any final comments?
The only final comment is earlier today you heard testimony on a bill from Representative Miller regarding building new veterans' homes. I think that's important. I also think it's important to take care of those that we have now. Okay. Thank you for your consideration.
You bet. With that, I am renew my motion that House File 1925 be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment without recommendation. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thanks for the treats, too. Okay, we've got Representative Clark. And a little looks like Representative Clark, you've got an amendment as well.
No.
No? I'm going to move House File 1073. There is an A2 amendment that changes the amount from 1.9 to 1,029,000. Was that the intent?
Madam Chair, I guess that's correct.
Okay. All right.
I didn't have that with you.
I'm going to move that amendment too, so we can get the bill in the order in which you wish to have it. So, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Clark, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a handout. I don't know where our person is to hand out. So far. It is, and she comes back with him.
We do have a packet in our...
Does it include this?
I don't know, but we'll make sure when she comes back. We'll get that.
Good summaries, and we'll try to be brief. I heard your earlier request for that.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
I brought with me probably one of the best witnesses you could ever have, someone who's been with me for many, many years on what we're trying to do here, which is restoring our Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery located in South Minneapolis. It's an amazing cemetery. I know many of you have been there on bonding committee trips and otherwise, and it's got a historical value that is just exceptional. So I'm going to turn it over to Susan Ware to tell you what she's been doing with this incredible asset to our state and why it's so special. And what we're asking for is very minimal in terms of helping protect the cemetery. So I'm going to turn it right over to her. We've been working on it for a while, and I hope this can be the last.
I think we heard it last time, didn't we?
Who?
Yes, because I remember Ms. Ware. So welcome to the committee again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I can do that. So many of you have heard me before. Are we going to be able to get this?
No, I'm trying to figure out who with that. You have
the
PowerPoint.
No, I think we might need a little bit of this.
Yeah. We also have the PowerPoint presentation in our packet. So if you want to start and she gets it going, great. If not, we can manage.
Is that it? That's not it.
I guess we don't have our own computer.
It's right here on the computer.
Okay,
here
we go.
We'll go.
Yeah. So the very first slide, I think the important thing is about the cemetery is it is listed in the National Register of Historic Sites. And what's interesting about that is it was listed, it is true it's a City of Minneapolis landmark, but it was actually in the National Register before it became a city landmark. And for many years, it was the only cemetery in the state of Minnesota listed. It's very difficult to get cemeteries listed because, by definition, they're all historic, right? That's what they're about. So this one began in 1853, which means 5 years before Minnesota was a state. And we have over 20,000 people buried in this cemetery. It's at the intersection, if you're not familiar with it, the intersection of Cedar Avenue and Lake Street in South Minneapolis. Over 20,000 people, over 10,000 of them are children under the age of 10. It's the only cemetery, well, you mentioned that. In 1928, the City of Minneapolis took over responsibility for maintaining the cemetery. Before that, it had been privately owned. And they still, to this day, do maintenance on the cemetery. That one? Okay. What's interesting about the cemetery and the reason why it's listed in the National Register, it has ties to the anti-slavery movement in Minnesota through its connection with the First Baptist Church of Minneapolis. And the photograph that you have there is one of my favorite inmates, I guess, Mr. Collins. This cemetery was never racially segregated, and going back to 1853, that says quite a lot. So it has a very interesting history that way. The Lehman family who owned it attended the first. They were among the founding members of the First Baptist Church. And in the cemetery, we have members of the Native American community. We have thousands of immigrants, as you can imagine, given the timing of when people were coming to Minnesota because of the Homestead Act and assorted other things. And early settlers all sort of mixed in together. We have veterans. We have a lot of talk about veterans today. We have kind of a bumper crop of War of 1812 vets. We've got four of them, which given the timing of the state, these gentlemen would have been in their 60s and 70s when they came, which back then was a lot older than it is now, I think. We have four of them. We have our number of Civil War vets keeps rising. We keep finding more because of the Internet, and Spanish-American war vets as well. Last year, I ordered 13 new military markers. We're starting a replacement program, and that's 3,000 pounds of marble, which is a lot of marble, and we will be setting those sometime this year. We have a potter's field, a pauper's section with some 2,300 people buried in it, most of them new arrivals, immigrants, who couldn't afford to be buried somewhere else. And the Grand Army of the Republic purchased a block of graves to keep veterans from being buried in the pauper's section. And that's where, when we celebrate Memorial Day every year, which we have since 1868, the veterans place the wreaths and where the honor guard does the 21-gun salute. The next slide is some folks who are buried there. The African-American gentleman, Captain John Cheatham, we believe is the first African-American firefighter for the city of Minneapolis. He was promoted 3 times, and we have at least one and possibly 2 others as well who are among the early firefighters. The man to his, at least on my right, Martin Lehman, is the original owner, lived to a ripe old age, astonishingly had 13 children, all of whom survived to adulthood and produced at least one heir. So there are Lehmans everywhere. We have Captain Charles Nudd, one of our Civil War vets. And then the child, the baby, her family placed a marker on her grave just a few years ago, say 10 years ago, and the minister from St. Peter's Danish Lutheran Church came out and did a graveside service over 100 years after this child died. So what we're working on is restoring the fence, which was built in 1928. The steel pickets are done, and they're painted a very nice shade of green. So what the request is for is the pillars. There are 65 limestone pillars dating back to 1928. Some of them have been repaired at various times and frankly not very well. They use the wrong kind of adhesive, and what happens is if it dries too hard, it splits. It can shatter limestone, which is much softer. So the idea is to disassemble all of these pillars, reassemble them using the right adhesive, and place an acrylic cap on the top so that water does not seep in and eat out the inside of the pillars, which is what happened, we found out, when we rehung the gates, which weigh a lot. The men who were hanging it found out that the pillars were hollow and had to bring in a civil engineer to create enough structure to support the weight of that metal. And the other thing is to place along the 21st Avenue side, we always jokingly refer to it as our historic chain link, going back to 1928. Well, in 1928, it didn't much matter what was on 21st Avenue because it was a streetcar turnaround. It's where the trolleys were. But today, it's an Aldi's grocery store, and up above are apartments and condos. So it's now residential. And it would be nice to give them a little something nicer to look at than historic chain link, which is pretty banged up. So that's kind of where we are. And that's what this request is for, is to fund those things, to restore the piers and the fence along the 21st Avenue side. And you can see that, the financial breakdown. I'm not the expert on that, but you can see what the numbers are. So the question becomes, it is my job, I'm chair of a group called Friends of the Cemetery, and my job is basically to make you all care about this place. The question becomes, why? And the answer is because it really does capture the history of the state. It is an astonishing place, quite humble in appearance, but it tells stories that are just beyond our imagining. It's the only green space between the river and the lakes on the west end of Lake Street. So for a very big stretch, it's 22 acres. We planted 150 trees in, got to do my math here, 2,350th anniversary, and we chose them for biodiversity to bring back birds other than creepy crows, which were pretty much all we had for a while. We have actually tapped the maple trees and made syrup as just a public relations gesture. Friends of the Cemetery, the group I'm with, has been doing fundraising and raising public awareness. We are, as far as I know, the first cemetery, certainly in the state, to have a rock concert in a cemetery. It paid off. American Express gave us $20,000 for doing that in addition to the ticket sales, and that was money we dedicated to the fence. We show movies, we do tours, we have a smartphone history hunt, and we have just a ton of partners in this. We have gotten support over the years from Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, have been big supporters from us, for us, as have Preserve Minneapolis, and of course the city of Minneapolis, but also scouts, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, every kind of scouts, American Legion posts and VFW posts. St. Olaf alumni come up every year for Earth Day. We are their project. We are their service project. South High School students visit us to learn about history, to write stories, and to study science. Group from Museum Meetup are our volunteers who they collect tickets at our movies that we show. We show four movies that are chosen by Trilon Micro Cinema, one of the local neighborhood businesses. The Daughters of the American Republic, the DAR, have given us money. Daughters of 1812, every single one of their members adopted a picket and fence, every single one throughout the state, and they're scattered everywhere. The Daughters of Union Veterans gave us $1,000 recently to set these 13 markers to pay our a man who normally volunteers, but 13 is a lot of volunteering. We've had U of M grad students who have helped us kind of think about strategies for fundraising. The University of Minnesota purchased a marker for people whose remains were used by the medical school way back when, well over 100 years ago. The Friends and Neighbors in the Phillips community, which is where this is housed, and the Alley newspaper, where I'm writing column 145 this weekend. So the question is, what's new? What's different this year than last year? Well, we now have seven more vets than we did last year. Several of them Civil War vets, two from the Spanish-American War, and some peacetime, who are all eligible to receive new military markers. I talked to two families this week alone. Five new headstones will be going in. These are for people who died 100 years ago or more. And I was telling Representative Clark, it's sort of, the stories in this place are really quite remarkable. I've been talking to the pastor of St. James AME Church in Minneapolis, which is the oldest African-American community in Minneapolis. And they don't have much of a written history. It was just not kept. And I said, I think I have some of your people. And I am willing to, you know, anything I've got is yours. And in the process of looking for more people, I came across a man whose name is John Wesley Justice, who may or may not have been a member of that church. But he died in 1909 from TB. And what's interesting about him is he was born in Virginia, African-American man, in 1871. His father was named Isaac Justice, and he was born in Virginia, 1837. So all of a sudden I'm thinking, this gentleman was probably a slave. What becomes even more interesting is his father was also named Isaac, but his family's name was Hope. So the family name shifted from Hope to Justice at the time of the Civil War. That's our expense.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Ware. I appreciate it. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Questions, members? Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And any of the veterans that, you know, we have 70, approximately 72 Medal of Honor recipient veterans, and many of those were from the Civil War. From your recollection or from your records, are any of those buried in that cemetery?
That I don't know, but we have a volunteer who is very, very actively working on finding out exactly those kinds of things. What's interesting is we sort of gain, I don't know how you can gain and lose vets, but some people that were earlier identified as vets have turned out, you know, with a name like John Johnson in Minnesota, you're kind of a challenge figuring out what it is. So he's looking at people, so we have first Minnesota folks who are at Gettysburg. We know we have several of those, and they're very interesting. The stories themselves are kind of fascinating, so we will find out.
Thank you.
It just takes a while. So,
okay. Members, any other questions? Representative Clark, final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really hope that we can move this bill forward and help protect the cemetery and everything that you heard about it today. Thank you.
Great. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1073, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment without recommendation. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Clark.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer. Representative Detmer moves House File 755. I see you have two testifiers. As you know, brevity is greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll keep my comments brief. The bill, House File 755, is a bill that would provide $250,000 from the state to complete the Medal of Honor memorial that is to be located near the Veterans Service Building in the Capitol Complex. I think most of you know where that fountain that hasn't worked for years, but that's going to be the location for this memorial. We had a groundbreaking ceremony last summer, and the memorial was authorized in 2016 session. And one thing that I am very happy about is the money would only be available for the project if the rest of the cost of the memorial is provided through the non-state funds. You know, they've been doing a very good job raising non-state funds, matching funds. So I'd like to turn it over to, we have three people here, but only two are going to testify.
Appreciate it. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Tiffany Kovaleski, and I'm the co-chair for the Minnesota Medal of Honor Memorial. And I'm joined here with Paul Mandel with the CAP board and the chairman of the memorial, John Kramer. I'm speaking today on behalf of our nonprofit 501c3 board and on the House File 755 for an appropriation of $250,000 for a memorial being built directly under the Veterans Services Building on our Capitol Mall. It's nice to see some familiar faces, and I apologize if this is redundant here, but I'll make this very quick with our notes here. For those that are unfamiliar with the Medal of Honor, it is our nation's highest and rarest military decoration awarded by the President of the United States in the name of Congress. There are currently 75 living Medal of Honor recipients in the United States, and there are about 3,500 total. Considering the nature of the criteria, most receive this posthumously. The state of Minnesota has 72 accredited Medal of Honor recipients that received the majority of them received this during the Civil War. Currently, there is one Medal of Honor, living Medal of Honor recipient, Leo Thorsness. He was born and raised in the Little House on the Prairie, Walnut Grove. He and his wife, Haley, reside in Florida currently. The living Medal of Honor recipients make up the society, and the society has created the Medal of Honor Foundation, which has two entities, the Citizen Honors Awardees, which is a program that you can nominate local citizens that have gone above and beyond the call of duty, and the Character Development Program. The Character Development Program is based on the six characteristics of the Medal of Honor, and the recipients themselves go around to school visits and teach the children about the six characteristics that they themselves can be heroes within themselves, even on their worst days, too. This program, this resource, is open for every child, no matter their sex, their religion, refugee, you name it. There is no discrimination whatsoever. I've been fortunate enough to be able to be part of a team over the last 2 years in conjunction with the Medal of Honor Convention last year, in which we were able to hold 5 CDP trainings, over 250 teachers in attendance, 17 school visits, and the statistics kind of go on and on. I highly recommend any of you, if you'd like to attend a training like Representative Pugh, that you're more than welcome to always attend. We would be more than happy to have you. This is also a free resource. There is no funding required for the Character Development Program. So since then, the Medal of Honor Memorial has taken this lasting value that the convention has put forth, and we want to make sure that this doesn't go all for nothing. So the memorial itself is on our Capitol Mall, and for those of you that were able to partake in the groundbreaking ceremony that we had on October 3rd, it was quite successful. To date, since the ceremony, we have started soliciting funds for this. We're asking for a $250,000 appropriation from the state of Minnesota, which is a 1-to-2 ratio on the recommendation of the CAP board, which is not very uncommon to ask for. The total cost project is $780,000 for the memorial itself. And we've recently started sponsorship. We've verbally had around $100,000 of verbal agreements. And we have meetings scheduled in the next coming months with major corporations that have interest, that have already donated to the convention, that are interested in continuing on this legacy within our state of Minnesota. For those of you that are familiar with the location of this, on the directly under the Veterans Services Building, there is the Promise of Youth sculpture. We're going to be taking this Promise of Youth sculpture and repurposing it. We're going to be utilizing this as a metaphor with the Promise of Youth as the character development program. We're taking the Promise of Youth and making it look, this is going to represent the youth of our state, and we're going to be surrounding it with the new Minnesota Medal of Honor Memorial. For those of you that know the recipients, you know that they serve us more in peace than they ever have in war. With them surrounding our youth, this is the first multi-generational memorial to sit on our Capitol Mall. I myself am excited to sit around with my children, with my parents and my grandparents, and to sit around and have reflections and to have memories here on our Capitol Mall, and to be able to talk about these six characteristics and to talk about the veterans, to talk about my stories, my children's stories. What are these things that represent? My four-year-old is sitting in the audience today. His version of sacrifice is having to come here with me today as he does not have school. But my version of sacrifice and yours too for being here today. I'm keeping this quick. The memorial itself is a zero-depth gravity pool. As you can see in this picture, this is something that you can go up and you can touch. We've really taken into serious consideration the construction and the design of this, as we don't want children falling into a pool. We don't want something that's going to be currently broken like the last one has been for the past 20 years. So the water feature will be able to be shut off during the winter months. And it is a polished granite where it will still look very nice even if the water is not functioning. Around it you have stones from Lake Superior, and then you'll have the walls that will have the six characteristics inscribed inside of them. We do plan on having an annual event every year that will generate families to come onto the Capitol Mall, as it's estimated 200,000 people attend the Capitol Mall annually. We'll also have family participation and I don't want to say scavenger hunts because that is not the word that we want to use, but we will have some type of forum where families will be able to interact with the community and one another and have a day on the Capitol Mall. With that being said, we're very, very excited to have this multi-generational memorial to provide a place of reflection for all ages. And I'm open for any questions, and Paul Mandela is here with the Capital Area Planning Board that can answer any of the technical questions as far as the memorial feature itself. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Kowaleski. Does your son want a treat at home?
Fortunately, thank you, Madam Chair, John Holtquist already got him an Irish cookie.
He was over there because I can't. Oh, poor kid. My mom and dad used to do that to me all the time. And see, that's just mean. I'm sorry.
And he's got a green shirt on, a beautiful green shirt on, too.
If it's any consolation, we are going to the parade next.
All right, good. Good to reward for good behavior, too. I do have a serious question, that being said. Going back, did you say that you have $100,000 pledged so far?
Verbally.
Okay. And so do you know. So it's going to be a little while yet before you kind of get the remaining funds. Would you be able to start if you got, is it shovel ready? If you got the $250,000, would that be able to get you going right away?
No, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. We will have to raise the $780,000 in order to break ground for this. It is a requirement of the CAP board, and we are actively fundraising very hard. It is a full-time, almost full-time duty of ours.
Okay. All right. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on this bill? Mr. Mandel, did you want to add anything?
Madam Chair, Paul Mandel, Executive Secretary for the CAP Board. I know Tiffany has expressed in other hearings that her goal is to have this fundraised by this time next year, at which point we would then hopefully proceed into construction documents and bids. So we would, getting the money at this point would be extremely helpful. Also, it would show her private fundraisers that the state is handed up.
Okay. All right. Any other questions, members? Representative Detmer, final comments?
Just final comments. Being able to meet some of these Medal of Honor recipients this last summer at the Medal of Honor convention, going to some of the activities, and now being able to put together a memorial that could be used educationally for our students and for our families. Thank you for hearing the bill.
Great. With that, Representative Detmer renews his motion that House File 755 be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment without recommendation. All of those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill is on its way. Thank you so much, and have fun at the parade.
Thank you.
Members, I'm going to move House File 2336, our last bill on the agenda. And this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the State Government Finance Bill. Members, this bill is dealing with free filing of your taxes. This is something that Representative Joaquin had a bill, not the same, but with the same concept in mind. Senator Rest has carried this legislation for a couple of years as well. And for me, I see it as an opportunity for us to make the lives of our citizens easier, and then also to achieve some cost savings for the state as well. This is something that has been done in the state of California. And when it was initially set up, of course, there was folks, tax preparers, that were opposed to it because it takes business away from them. But what it does in the end game is it makes the process of filing your taxes easier. And, you know, though we're kind of used to government documents and forms and things like that because we deal with them on a day-to-day basis, for the average Joe citizen, the process itself is rather intimidating. And I think about my sister who files very simple taxes, and she just gets every year, stressed out over filing your taxes. And I think it's more about the fact that you don't want to screw up because you don't want to have the IRS coming after you and just that fear of making an error. And so for citizens, this bill is an effort to make it easier for them by having the Department of Revenue offer this. And what would happen is the Department of Revenue would send out to them. They get all the information with your W-2s and all that. And they basically pre-fill out the form for you. And then they send it to you, and you look it over to make sure that everything is correct. And if you want to amend it, you can amend it. If you don't and you're good with it, then it goes back to the state, and the state files it, and boom, you're done. On the state of California, when they did this, they said the average cost for doing this return would be 34 cents compared to the traditional way that you do it at $2.59. So you're seeing a significant cost savings by going this route. So that's the idea behind this. I know the Department of Revenue said that they might want to comment on this. I don't see Mr. Cummings here today. Is he? Oh, you're hiding. Come on down. I know the department wants to speak to it as well. Yes. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members, I am comforted by the fact that I still may be able to hide in this building. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to come before this committee today. Tax season is upon us. It is the one annual experience from all experienced people from all slices of Minnesota share, and that is doing your taxes. Creating an environment in which our customers voluntarily report, pay, and receive the right amount is our vision at the Department of Revenue that we strive for. In order to meet that vision, removing any roadblocks from voluntarily complying should be our goal, and I think that that is what your bill, Representative Anderson, is trying to do. We have strategies at the Department of Revenue to achieve our vision, and they are aligned with the goals of this bill, including providing our customers with information, education and services, creating operational efficiencies and leverage technology to secure customer information and to meet customer and employee needs, and then to listen to our customers, identify and develop improvements to the revenue system. And I think we share the same goals. When I came to the department in 2011, trying to remove some barriers from filing like free file was something that made me excited about taking the job at the Department of Revenue to partner with others in that work. There happened to be other issues in 2011 that sort of focused everyone else's attention. As you've mentioned, Madam Chair, there have been similar attempts in the past. In 2015, Senator Rest and Representative Joaquin and I have been warned about speaking about the other body while being in the House. They introduced a similar bill directing the department to develop and implement a system for the secure electronic filing of individual income tax return and payment of individual income tax liabilities for the next filing season. In the course of working with them on the bills, you know, we learned a lot. They learned a lot, and so did we all, about what people expect when filing their taxes. So people said they wanted a solution that does more than allow them to fill in a PDF copy of a tax return and then email it to us. They want a solution that is wizard-like functionality that asks them questions and walks through them completing the return so they can maximize their credits. They wanted a solution that makes it easy for them to file an accurate tax return. They want a solution that works for all taxpayers and not just those who have a simple return or those with income at certain levels or other restrictions. And they want a solution that does not require them to go to multiple different places to file a return, one place to file a federal return and another place to file a state return. From our perspective, in order to successfully administer the tax system, at minimum, the department would need a solution that keeps the return filing process linked to the IRS MEF process, which is the modernized electronic filing process. It maintains the security and safety of taxpayer information. It does not create an environment for filing of fraudulent returns. It keeps up with all state and federal tax law changes so that taxpayers can file in a timely and accurate tax return, and is easy for taxpayers to use, creating a more accurate return that reflects the tax benefits that taxpayers are entitled to. If we build a solution that meets the taxpayer and the needs of the agency, it would essentially make us a software vendor, much like Intuit, who does TurboTax and H&R Block. We have worked to become one of the best revenue departments in the country on responding to issues that come up in filing season, including return processing, as well as fraud prevention and detection, which our busy season is about the same time that this will be rolled out. We have tried to provide our customers with online tools, forms, and guidance that meet the highest standards so they can depend on them as they voluntarily report and pay their taxes. There remain many unknowns about how this could be done, how the timeline could work, and how it could be managed during our busiest season. We are motivated to find a free file solution that works best for our customers. We want to ensure that this work meets our highest standards. Taking the time needed to find out this method is the best way to finally have a robust free file option for Minnesotans that makes the most sense. After Senator Rest and Representative Joaquin worked with stakeholders, interested constituents, and hearing many of the unknowns about the impact moving ahead quickly, they decided that it might be the best option to have a study. Although we have identified a number of elements that are important to this system, a study and report will allow us to gather information about potential solutions. It will allow us to test our internal thinking with technology experts, including companies who provide filing software, to ensure we can explore options and consideration for all stakeholders. As part of the report, we would compare what other states are doing, the relative costs and the results. We can leverage private sector expertise in the topic by issuing a request for information to gather the most current thinking on a solution. A study could really help us to see if a government-built approach works best or if a public-private partnership is the better option. But as I close, Representative Anderson, we really appreciate you bringing this forward, and we certainly share the same goals. As this bill moves forward to other stops, as taxes or others, we look forward to continuing the conversation with you, Chair Anderson, other interested members, stakeholders, and staff. Thank you.
Thank you. I bet Mr. Ransom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Ransom. I'm a partner at the law firm McDermott Will & Emery in Washington, D.C., where I lobby and practice law. And parenthetically, I'll try to be brief, but parenthetically, it's always good to come back to St. Paul. I'm a graduate of William Mitchell, graduated there in 1992. That's now, as you know, Mitchell Hamlin. So today I come before the committee as counsel of the American Coalition for Taxpayer Rights, a 13-member National Trade Association of the nation's largest tax preparers, and the financial institutions that offer tax time bank products that are chosen by millions of Americans each tax season. ACTR members are the most recognizable names in the tax preparation industry and include companies that offer retail tax preparation services, do-it-yourself tax software, and professional tax preparation products. We are very familiar with legislation such as House File 2336 and its Senate companion, and believe that such efforts, even while well-intentioned, are nevertheless unwarranted and potentially very expensive for the state and its taxpayers. Based on our experience with similar efforts in other states, we question whether the state would want to assume the role of tax preparer alongside its existing and appropriate roles of assessing tax returns for compliance with state law and as a tax enforcement agency. This legislation, if enacted, would require an expensive infusion of additional monetary resources to the State Department of Revenue to allow it to build the software and systems that would be necessary. I believe it was Mr. Cummings alluded to that. We are not aware of a cost estimate of the bill's procurement requirements. Today, though, these are expenditures that are made by private sector companies like ACTR members that provide services to Minnesota taxpayers in an efficient and economical manner. There are several reasons to oppose the bill, and I'll outline just a few and be happy to take any questions. First, the current Minnesota Free File program with industry has been very successful and could be even more successful in our judgment. Today, most Minnesotans can get their tax returns prepared for free through the Free File program and have their choice of software vendors, so they're not locked into simply one single software vendor. Since 2003, more than a dozen private sector tax preparation companies have made their software available free of charge to taxpayers earning less than $64,000 per year. That figure is adjusted annually, so it always covers the lowest earning 70% of U.S. taxpayers. If Minnesota were to enact this legislation under consideration, the Free File program rules, which are established by the IRS and the states, would require the termination of the program, and Minnesotans would no longer be able to avail themselves of the Free File program. Secondly, other states that have built government-run tax filing systems have chosen to discontinue them. Several have, including South Carolina, New York, Virginia, and Massachusetts. In fact, New York and Massachusetts, after discontinuing their state-run programs, have begun to participate in the Free File program again. And just very briefly, two other points. There are practical issues that need to be considered by policymakers such as you if you were to establish a state-run program. you would need, for example, to establish 800 call centers for taxpayers who run into problems with their tax filing. Also, you would need to build a system that could handle a high number of returns at peak times of the tax filing season, usually early and late in the tax filing season, as you would expect. So we believe this could force the Department of Revenue to divert funding, employees, and resources from other critical issues and activities. And then finally, there are potential inherent conflicts of interest when the state itself is not only the tax auditor, and the tax investigator, and the tax enforcer, but also the tax preparer. For example, just to outline a couple, you'd have to determine, would the state use the keystrokes of a taxpayer on a state-run system to guide audits? For example, would the state flag a return if a taxpayer changed his or her charitable deduction in the return? The implications for having the state function as the tax preparer as well as the auditor enforcer are profound, and we would argue need to be considered by you, the policymakers. In conclusion, we support the public interest objective of providing assured access to free tax preparation and e-filing services for those who need the most. The Minnesota Free File Program provides truly free services and does so at no cost to the state or to the individual, and it provides both state and federal returns. With this in mind, we would recommend that the public interest could be best advanced by perfecting this bill to instead make the Minnesota Free File Program permanent as a matter of law, just as Virginia and Mississippi have done for their taxpayers. We would enthusiastically support such a bill and recommend it for your consideration. I want to thank you for your time and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ransom. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Members' questions. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I enjoyed the testimony from Mr. Cummings. It confirmed the, popular belief. He said Minnesota's Department of Revenue was number one in the nation, and there confirms that Minnesota's the best at collecting taxes. But to the bill, I had two queries. One, and it could be offline, I know this is under development, would this free file, those returns be exempt from audit, since the state would both be the preparer and the auditor? And the other question is confirmation that no additional data would be provided if you go through this process than the state already would have or would get with a normal return. Those are just the two questions I had.
Sure. And Representative Quam, on the question of access to data, they would only have the data that would traditionally be involved in filing your taxes, so that wouldn't change at all. Mr. Cummings, can you come to the table? I would assume that people would be free from audit if they were to file this way, but can you verify? Thank you, Mr. Ransom. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't see any prohibition in this bill that would do that. And, you know, partly there's some times in which the Department of Revenue may learn various facts that would facts or circumstances that would come up. There are times in which audits are done based on some calculation issues that happen. But if there are issues with the type of information that is provided, if the charitable contributions are not correct or something else happens. So I would assume that that the method of filing would not be restrictive in terms of who would be auditing or who would be audited and who wouldn't be audited. That would be my assumption.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I can understand that, but there are, I assume, software analyses that are run on returns, and that if you're using the same thing to generate with the data, I would be surprised that you would have an auto flag
unless there was an outside indication that there, you know, like you said, a charity contribution. But I would think that if you're going to be flagging it with that software, you would let the person know ahead of time we've got additional concern and queries. I mean, that would just be an automatic process if the state was doing it. So we don't want to drag this on and belabor it, but I think that's one point that maybe a little bit of research and offline communication would be useful.
Any other questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this question, I like the spirit of this and to make it easier for taxpayers, and I think that's great. Just the curiosity of how come not looking into the possibility of private, you know, public-private partnership on this, and just could you just share a little bit about that?
Sure.
And then my next question would be the cost to the department to do this, and how do you see that, or how does the department see that? I don't see the cost in here, but I assume there may be cost implications to implement this.
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Olson, this Department of Revenue already has contracts with vendors to under the free file program, and those are for individuals that have income at $64,000 in federal taxable income. So we already have those contracts for individuals servicing those people. But what's unique about this program and what we're doing here is we're asking for the Department of Revenue to provide a series of reports in examining this issue. So it's much like the study as Senator West has authored. It's putting out, so by February 2018, they have to examine other states that have done this, California being one of the examples. By August of 2018, they have to have the final statistics on the pilot program and plans to implement it. And then in September of 2019, just the usage of it and which ways it could be expanded and so forth. So that's kind of a series of steps, if you will, that what this bill does. So we've already got those partnerships. This doesn't impact those. I think the testifier, Mr. Ransom, had said that would null and void all those. That doesn't change that at all. All we're doing is we're offering a different option for taxpayers to file their taxes, another option in addition to everything else that we currently offer, so that they can make their lives easier. And what's unique about this, too, is it's not limited by income either. It's not, you don't have to be below the $64,000 in federal taxable income. Instead, this offers it to anybody that has a simple tax return that just gets nervous about filing their taxes and rather do it this way or don't have the time and so forth. But to your question on costs on this, Mr. Cummings.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we don't have a completed fiscal note on this, but I could just preview that we do think the costs would be significant. You know, we would be, in a very short amount of time, need to make ourselves essentially into a vendor. So we would have to come up with the type of product. And to have it sort of wizard-like functionality, so that people could maximize their types of returns. I think Representative Kwan made some great points about trying to, you know, what are those extra items in order to provide assurance to taxpayer to, you know, cut down on some of those issues that might come up with calculation errors. You know, it the costs in order to develop that would be significant, especially on the front end. I would also mention that we would see an increase in some ongoing maintenance functionality like call centers and other types of things. If this is something that is to be moved forward, we obviously will be developing a full fiscal note for the committee.
And Mr. Cummings, how much did the department spend on the moving the renter's credit to online?
Madam Chair, I don't know what the how much that costs or what
if
that
you
was.
Provide that data to us, yeah. I think that would be helpful. That's something that the Department of Revenue already does. I haven't been made aware that that required any additional staff time or money to move the online filing of the renter's credit. So
When I look at this, obviously the Department of Revenue has done this in a smaller form already, and so I have full confidence in their capabilities to do this in other ways as well. And I know, Mr. Cummings, that the Department of Revenue also operates their 1-800 number. I think Mr. Williamson said that this would require us to have a 800 call center, but we already have one in place. If you need the number, it's 1-800-657-3666. Members, are there any other questions to this bill? If not, I'm going to give my closing comments. I want to address some of the things that Mr. Ransom also pointed out. Having to build a system, we already have this in place. This is part of the responsibilities of the Department of Revenue to do this. This would not, again, discontinue the free file program. We have those contracts in place. It doesn't make them canceled discontinue them in any way. It just gives the taxpayers another option that makes their lives easier. And as Speaker Dowd started this legislative session, he put together a special committee that's designed with making lives better for Minnesotans, making things easier, providing government service that is easier for citizens to access and use, and just be more consumer friendly for the citizens that we represent. On those that were mentioned on other states that ended the program, there was extreme pressure, obviously, from the tax preparers because they stand to benefit from having more people using their services. So there's extreme pressure in those states to end them for those interest groups. And I think that I see this as a proper role for government when we're requiring people to do this exercise, that we try to make it as easy as possible for them to comply and also to reduce our costs. And as I mentioned earlier, in California, they received a cost savings at the end of the day from full implementation. At the end of the day, they are seeing a cost savings. Rather than it costing $2.59 per file, it's 34 cents. So you're seeing over a dollar savings per filing that you have. And with that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2336 be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government finance bill. And with that, members, thank you for your patience. Thanks for coming in on a Friday, and we are